And remember today, the order of our agenda is to have the public hearing and possible work session on SSJR 38A. And then we will skip down to have a public hearing only on HJR 42. And then we'll go right back up to the Senate Bill 135 and then complete the rest of the hearings that are on the schedule. So with that then, let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on SJR 38A. And Senator Flarno, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And again, I would like... I'm Bev Flarno, from State Senator from Deschutes County, and again, I would like to thank you very much for speedily scheduling this bill and for your staff for their hard work on helping us get this bill moving along. I really appreciate you hearing it, and I will appreciate it if you're able to move it out of committee. Resolution is SJR 38 in recognition of the P-38 that Rex Barber flew. Colonel Rex Barber was a remarkable man. Growing up in the Culver area where his parents homesteaded, Mr. Barber joined the U.S. Air Force during World War II. He flew 110 wartime missions in China and the Pacific and became a certified ace, having shot down at least 5 enemy planes. His most notorious flight surely came during the early morning hours of April 18, 1943. Mr. Barber flew his P-38 Lightning in a 16-plane unit for 435 miles at no more than 50 feet above the ocean to avoid detection. His mission was to intercept and shoot down Admiral Yamamoto, the commander of the Japanese Combined Fleet and strategist behind the attack on Pearl Harbor. Colonel Barber completed his mission by intercepting Admiral Yamamoto's plane and shooting it down. After that, from 1943 to early 1944, he flew his P-38 with the 449th Fighter Squadron, 23rd Fighter Group in China, where he shot down several more planes and was himself shot down and injured. The new Highway 97 bridge over the Crooked River Gorge is an architectural marvel, soaring 300 feet above the river, framed against the Central Oregon sky. It is a fitting tribute to name this bridge in Colonel Barber's honor and for his patriotism and his continuous devotion and love to our country. This dedication will only be a fraction of the reverence that is deserved by such an honorable man, and I would appreciate your support in honoring Mr. Barber and our veterans. This will be the Rex T. Barber Veterans Memorial Bridge. So I appreciate your kindness in hearing the bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Westland.
I have a dental appointment. I'd much rather stay with you.
Well, Senator, let me just check. I'm sorry, I didn't ask the committee if there was any questions for the senator.
No. Mr. Chair?
Oh, sure.
I just might say this story about Admiral Yamamoto, I was just recently watching the History Channel, and mm-hmm. I saw that yes. account in their version. So,
And I would just add that Mr. Barber... finished out his life, having passed away last year, finished out his life in his community by being Cub Scout leader, many, many community things, including Mayor of Redmond and many other things. So we appreciate you recognizing him in this way. And I do have a dental appointment. I would much rather stay with all of you.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, I now know one thing that is less desirable than testifying in front of a legislative committee is going to the dentist.
Representative Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Ben Westland, House District 53, Central Oregon. I sincerely appreciate you bringing this bill forward. The heroic actions of Colonel Barber speak for themselves. As you know, he is widely credited with significantly shortening the Pacific Theater of World War II. It is not difficult by any stretch of the imagination to imagine that this single act saved the lives of thousands of Americans, thousands of our fathers and mothers, indeed the mothers and fathers of many Oregonians, and indeed I would submit the fathers and mothers of many of us who work and serve in this very building. No one wakes up to be a hero.
and true heroes don't go to bed on the evening of their action, knowing the implications of their profound accomplishment. And so it was with Colonel Barber. A husband, father, committed community leader. It was actually Rex's quiet, unassuming manner that eventually led to this well-earned recognition. Colonel Barber isn't just a Culver or Madras or Central Oregon hero. He's an American hero. A regular guy who, in just doing his job, changed the course of world history. It is fitting, then, that on this occasion, on the completion of this bridge, that it be honored, that he be honored, by naming this magnificent facility, located close to his hometown anyway, the Colonel Rex T. Barber Memorial Bridge. Thank you for your attention. Bringing this bill forward, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I have a small question. How are bridges usually, how do they usually get their names, if not through the legislature? Does anyone know?
Traditionally, they are named by the ODOT Transportation Commission, and to be very succinct and not too blunt, there was some delay on the part of the Transportation Committee. Bob Bryant, I want to give Bob Bryant credit, the local ODOT manager who was pushing to see this accomplished, see this naming made. And in the end, I want to give all of ODOT credit because they have actually asked us to tell them that this is a good thing to do. So in the end, I think all's well that ends well, and this is certainly, I think, one of those occasions.
And, Representative, you may know this well, but my understanding is that there are not that many bridges. I mean, it's not an automatic that a bridge gets named after an individual. It's, you know, quite a
That is correct.
Standard.
I think that is the significance, part of the significance of this naming, and it's commensurate with the significance of Colonel Barber's accomplishment. I mean, this was no mean feat, you know, to fly, triangulate over open water and actually, you know, intercept the Japanese squadron. You see those guys out there, you know, with that antiquated navigational equipment, and they actually pulled it off and succeeded in their mission. And yet at the same time, the most important part of that component is what's, you know, on the battlefields of Iraq today. I mean, it's the heart and the soul and the courage and determination, you know, of the individual that's either behind the gun or in the plane or in the tank. I mean, it's the individual that does it. And Colonel Barber was such an individual.
Other questions? Representative, did Ms. Barber have family? I mean, is there still family in
there, the Barber family is a... I don't know if anyone's here that I recognize, but Rex Barber Jr. is still in the area. I'm sure he's got other relatives. It's a very well-established family. I mean, and that's part of the story that makes it so, I think, poignant and compelling is that here's a regular guy, regular hometown guy, goes off, actually shoots down the lead Japanese admiral, and comes home and leads a quiet, unassuming life, committed to his community, as Senator Carno indicated. I mean, he's on the school board and mayor of a local town, and he's just one of the type of people that built this country, made this country great, and is what allows us to enjoy the freedoms we allow today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions?
No?
Thank you. Okay, John Mangus.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to speak in support of Joint Resolution 38 and to thank Senator Clarno and Representative Westland for championing this idea. Actually, in April of 2001, in April of 2002, at the direction of the Governor's Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee, I wrote to the Department of Transportation to request that they consider naming the bridge over the Crooked River in honor of Rex Barber. And in October of 2002, the response that I received was the fact that they had a certain criteria that had to be met before they would name any highway facility after an individual, and that Mr. Barber did not meet that criteria at that time, and they would not recommend that on to the Transportation Commission. And one of the criteria was to demonstrate statewide support for naming a facility after an individual. And certainly, I know Senator Clarno has stacks of letters that she's received in support of this issue. Also, the American Legion is on record supporting this. United Veterans Group of Oregon, made up of 12 nationally chartered organizations, is on record as supporting this. The Governor's Advisory Committee supports this, and Governor Kulongoski supports this issue. So I think we met that criteria, and that the individual who facility will be named after has to be deceased, and Mr. Barber did pass away in July 2001. And the individual must have made a lasting contribution with a significant historic impact on Oregon. And the Highway or Transportation Division Department basically said that although this had national historic importance, that they did not see that as importance on the state of Oregon. And, of course, you'd have to argue that there were Oregonians at Pearl Harbor that were killed as a result of the attack on December 7th, but also the 41st Infantry Division that was made up of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho veterans was at that time slogging through the South Pacific and New Guinea. Admiral Yamamoto was the chief architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And the fact that he was killed by Mr. Barber's heroic actions saved many Oregonian lives. So I think we met the criteria of having an impact on the state of Oregon. And one of the criteria didn't make a lot of sense to me is that the bridge would have to be 535 feet long, or excuse me, a half mile long, and this bridge is only 535 feet. And fortunately, I don't think anybody cares about that. And I just think it's the right thing to do. The veterans of the state of Oregon are supportive of this. And Mr. Barber, he was a very mild-mannered individual. And it was actually recommended for the Medal of Honor for this action, but it was kept secret for a long time. And for a number of reasons, that was he never received the Medal of Honor, but the received, I think it was the Navy Cross in lieu of that. But I think there's enough evidence today that we could go back to the Congress of the United States and the President and even have that corrected. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I just think it's a great idea, and I hope you support it.
Thank you. Any questions? Guess not. Thank you. And Jim Willis, American Legion. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm the Legislative Commission Chairman for the American Legion throughout Oregon. In addition to that, I'm the Vice Chairman of the Governor's Advisory Committee to the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm also speaking for my brothers and sisters from the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Disabled American Veterans, and the Military Order of the Purple Heart. I don't want to plow any old ground here. I think the Senator, the Representative, and certainly Director Mangus have done a good job. There's just a couple things I'd like to add. One is that Colonel Barber completed an entire career in the United States Air Force, retiring in 1961 as a full colonel. That's when he returned to Culver. And the other two things to his public service I'd like to add was that, in addition to being a Little League coach, he was also a volunteer firefighter for 16 years, and he was elected Justice of the Peace, in addition to serving as the mayor. So this is a person who gave back to his community long after his retirement, after over 20-plus years in the armed forces. Another thing I'd like to add is that after the secret mission that resulted in the death of Admiral Yamamoto, many of the flyers in the 16-plane group, one of whom was lost during the mission, were shipped back to the United States to keep the fact that we'd broken the Japanese Naval Code secret. Colonel Barber, then a first lieutenant, volunteered to transfer to China, to the China-Burma-India Theater, where he flew additional missions in China and shot down additional Japanese aircraft and was declared an ace. I am a third-generation Oregonian. One of the things that I'm most proud about living in Oregon is that, unlike some states that I visited, not every bridge or highway or street or building is named after a person. In fact, very few are. So when we do discuss whether or not we ought to name a facility for an individual, Oregonians think long and hard before they do that. There currently is no state facility or highway or bridge named after any member of the World War II generation. Clearly, Colonel Barber is a genuine American hero, not just an Oregon hero. He's an American hero. He is a member of the World War II Aviation Hall of Fame, and should be. But more importantly, if I were to take a grandchild of mine to meet somebody that I said, this is a person that I'd like you to try to model your life after, I would use somebody like Rex Barber. He is a role model that people should be proud of, and that all Oregonians should be. And yet, if you were to meet him, you would never know of his accomplishment, because he would never bring it up. I'm the son of a Battle of the Bulge veteran. My father fought in Europe all through World War II, and he was exactly the same way. And only when I got back from Vietnam would my father ever discuss war with me at all. So that was a generation of individuals who made us what we are today. And so on behalf of the American Legion and VFW and the other veterans organizations I've mentioned, I urge the committee favorable consideration of this bill. This is the right thing to do, and this is the right person to honor. I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd welcome any questions of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
For your testimony. John Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Aurora, Oregon, appearing in front of you as a citizen. I was unable to make the Senate hearing on Mr. Barber's memorial. I regretted that I had to be out of town, and I appreciate your indulgence. I'm doing this as an obligation I feel to Mr. Barber, and to help flesh out a little bit of the picture of this man. He was a war hero, absolutely, but he was also just an absolutely fantastic human being. He retired, as you just heard, in 1961, moved back to Culver, which is my hometown. I moved to Culver in 1963 after my father passed away. My uncle lived out there. My mother and I moved out to my uncle's place. And Mr. Barber and my mother and Mrs. Barber got to be fast friends. Rex had a son, Rex Jr., who was in the same grade at school as me, and he and I got to be pals. His birthday, Rex Jr.'s birthday, is tomorrow. Don't know why I remember that. Probably the reason I can't remember much of other stuff, but Rex Barber's birthday is tomorrow, April 4th. Mr. Barber was a substitute dad for me. That's why I appreciate your indulgence here. This is very important to me. He helped raise me. My mother was a single mother back in the days when that wasn't that common. He taught me a lot of things. He took me hunting, helped me learn to drive. He gave me my first job when I was 13. He ran a big farm there. He put me to work roguing wheat, pulling the weeds out. He coached a little league team. He stood up for me at a couple events in school when you needed someone like that, a man to be there. And he didn't know anything about it. Like they said, he did not talk about his military service. I learned about it reading a book about it. But I do know that he was a hero of mine. And he helped me become the man I am. He's the kind of man I hope that I am with my children, with other people's children. And this honor is absolutely exactly what Rex would appreciate. He loved Central Oregon just as deeply as you can possibly love a place. And I know that because he helped teach me to love it. And that's still home for me. I'm making my living over here, but home is still Culver. And home, Culver, is people like Rex and Margaret, Rex Jr. Rex Jr. still farming down outside of Terrebonne. I'll quit the memory lane, folks. Thank you very much for allowing me this time to put my support for this on the record, because this is something I owe to Mr. Barber. Thank you very much for your time. Please do pass this out and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you. Questions? No.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Okay, that then concludes our public hearing. No others testify, so we'll close the public hearing and we will open up a work session on SJR 38. Representative Forrest?
Move to adopt. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adopt Senate Joint Resolution 38. And move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Forrest has moved adoption of Senate Joint Resolution 38 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Any discussion? Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking that not too often do we have the opportunity to perform a duty like we can today. So I certainly support this measure.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to comment after just watching the story on the History Channel about Colonel Barber, I feel like he's come alive for me today. Not only from the wonderful presentation about military, which I so appreciated, but also from John talking about what he meant to him as a boy. And I think it's not often that we get that kind of in-depth feeling about people that we can honor. So I strongly support this going to the floor with the due pass.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Discussion. Yes, Representative Flores.
And I can only add that what a wonderful tribute to American hero, but to place such an honor in that particular area, in that particular bridge, which would bring much fonder reflections and memories for me as I go through that area.
Right. Okay. Other discussion? Seeing none. Call the roll.
Aye.
Mayor Barnhart.
Excuse.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And having SJR 38 pass, the carrier will be Ben Westland. That then closes the work session on SJR 38, and we will open up a public hearing on HJR 42. And that's Michael Gillette. Come forward. Members, just so you know, the main proponent of this bill was still looking for some amendments from Legislative Council. So we will be taking testimony, just assuming from Justice Gillette, only today. And then when those amendments are prepared, then Representative Patridge will be down to discuss those. And, of course, we would welcome other comments at that time as well.
Chairman Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Michael Gillette, appearing as an individual. However, I have some background with respect to the topic of HJR 42, in as much as I'm the senior associate justice on the Oregon Supreme Court. Senior meaning only that I'm the oldest guy. It has no other significance. I thank Chairman Doyle and members of the committee for your indulgence in permitting me to testify in what amounts to testifying ahead of certain other matters, and I also appreciate you being willing to hear me today and recognizing that we don't yet know quite what Representative Patridge may come up with respect to amendments. But I doubt that anything that he would come up with would change the basic point that I wish to make for you today. I should explain to you that as a justice on the Oregon Supreme Court, I try not to ever appear here. This is your work, and this is one of the two political branches of government where you are responsible to the public in a different way, and I don't feel like I mix in very much. And I certainly, even when I appear here, try to appear here to provide information. Just I appear about a bill, but not for or against it. So to appear actually against something, which I'm doing here today, is extraordinarily rare for me in the 25-plus years I've been a judge. But I'm again this, and I want to explain why. The purpose of HGR 42 is to add to the list of officials who are subject now to Senate confirmation, judges who have been appointed by the governor. The argument in favor is a relatively simple one. The argument is that this simply conforms Oregon practice with the practice that's followed in the United States Senate with respect to appointees to the federal judiciary, and therefore there's a certain mirror image sort of quality to the proposal. The difficulty with the argument in favor, however, is that it failed to take into account two pivotal considerations. One is that federal judges are appointed for life, and therefore the only check that is ever going to exist on the appointment is going to occur in Senate confirmation. After they are appointed, nothing can get them removed from office except the same impeachment process that's used against the president. And I don't recall how many federal judges have been impeached in the 200 plus years of the Republic, but I think the number is six. So you get the idea that once a person becomes a federal judge, they're probably going to stick. And secondly, and this is an offshoot of the first, the lack of symmetry is illustrated by the fact that even though the United States Senate has an enormous number of appointments that it considers and with respect to which it must advise and consent in order for the appointment to be effective, there is no elected official as to whose position in office the United States Senate advises and consents. No elected official. Those are all people who serve in appointed positions in, as to which there will be no election. By contrast, all Oregon judges have to run for election every 6 years. The check with respect to us is supposed to be the ballot box. And it is illogical to add yet another check when the fundamental check for a nonpartisan office is the one that we've seen fit to create with respect to judges and we've had for well over 100 years. So I would submit respectfully, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Representative Patridge about this, but he and I have had conversations in the past, so he understands what my position is. I would submit respectfully that the premise on which the measure is based is wrong, and once the premise is removed, there's no basis for doing anything. Now, I recognize that when compared with the measure that you just discussed, a mere discussion of the fundamental structure of government kind of seems inhuman. But this is nonetheless important, and whether or not judicial appointments ought to be delayed or ought to be subject to Senate confirmation when they will be subjected to scrutiny at the next election and every 6 years thereafter seems to me to be a reasonably important question. I might add just one more thing, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and that is that one thing about it is my position with respect to this measure has nothing to do with me. I've already been appointed, and I've already been elected five times, and I will run once more, and if the electorate's kind enough to return me once more, that's it. So I don't face the problem in any event. So I have no dog in this fight except a concern for governmental structure. And with respect to that concern, my sense is this is not an appropriate addition to the Oregon Constitution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to deal with any questions.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Gillette, thank you for being with us today. Can you tell me how many of the Supreme Court judges that are now sitting were appointed?
Trying to figure whom to count and whom not. Judge Riggs came to the court first by election. Judge DeMunez came to the court by election. So two of the six who presently are serving, there's an open seat, as you may be aware. Two of the six came to the court first by election rather than by appointment. Two of the rest of us came by appointment from a governor of one party after having been appointed to another court by a governor of the other party. So it's a sort of interesting collection of characters, and I use that term advisedly.
Follow-up? So you're saying that four were appointed, four of the six. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me with the Court of Appeals how many of those that are now sitting were appointed?
Representative Close, members of the committee, to my recollection, every one of those persons was first appointed. There are not a lot of pitched battles over the privilege of serving on the court that decides more appellate cases per judge than any other in the United States. It's just plain hard work and people with good sense. I didn't have it. I served there. But people with good sense don't want the job.
Thank you.
I'm being whimsical. Obviously, it's a worthwhile job, but it's usually not contested. And there hasn't been a contested election for it that I can recall in a very long time.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you agree or disagree that most judges are on the ballot without opposition?
Representative Verger, members of the committee, I would say that probably 93 to 95% of judges appear unopposed. And I'm speaking of judges at all levels. It's equally true of judges at the trial level as well as the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. This is apparently becoming a little less true. There appears to be a slide toward more contested elections. There have been more contested elections for the Supreme Court in the last 10 years than I think there had been in the previous 30. But nonetheless, as a general proposition, far more judges are returned without opposition than with opposition. That, I have to add, includes me. I've run five times, and I've yet to draw an opponent. It's been my policy not to be opposed, and it's worked out very well thus far.
Follow up, please. Could you explain that, since all of us are elected people
yes,
as well?
Representative Verger, members of the committee, that it's a product of, I think, of two things. One is nobody notices us except on the rare occasion when we come down with a decision that makes everybody mad. And if we do that, usually they still can't figure out what court did it. They think the United States Supreme Court did it or the Court of Appeals did it. So there's many people literally do not understand the governmental structure the way it's set up. And so we're sort of below the radar screen. So there isn't a lot of interest in the public at large. And secondly, I think there is a sense on the part of most people who do follow the process that, by and large, the people who are performing the jobs probably are not doing too bad a job and ought to be left alone. It has not been expensive in the past to run a campaign for the court if one wished to do it. It's becoming expensive now. But it has not been heretofore, and yet, by and large, most people didn't even bother to pay the $50 filing fee, or what's now $100 filing fee, I guess. I'll be reminded of this in about a year when I file. But it has to do with lack of interest as much as anything else. And that's always struck me as kind of unfortunate, because it seems to me people ought to have a better grasp of what the third branch of government is doing. But I think it's fair to say that that's the reason.
Follow up, please.
Sure.
Do you think that you've made the case for confirmation?
I don't understand how I've made an ounce of a case for confirmation, Representative Verger, but I'm not a political person, so
okay.
I gather that you think I have, but let me try this, if I may, Mr. Representative Verger, members of the committee. If you think that the lack of opposition demonstrates there ought to be some other check in the process, keep in mind that that process, Senate confirmation, is going to occur before the person does anything. What kind of information is the Senate going to have with respect to that person that's going to be of any particular value, except this person can walk, talk, breathe, and appears to be smart enough to do the job? You don't have the kind of reference that would be useful. If you want to have Senate confirmation 10 years in, at least that would make some sense. You'd have a track record you could look at which would inform you with respect to whether this person really is a good judge or not. Mm-hmm. But at the outset, I'm sorry, ma'am, but no. Mm-hmm. I have not made any case for the Senate.
Well, I was joshing you a bit with that.
Well, I am an old lawyer and an old debater. When it's suggested I've just shot a hole in my own argument, it makes me nervous. It's probably also accurate.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do the other states, Western states in particular, how do they appoint their judges or elect, or what is their process?
Representative Monis Anderson, to my knowledge, every state in the West elects their judges, and I do not know of any state that has Senate confirmation, but I haven't done a study of it, and so don't rely on me on that. I don't know that I'm correct about that. But, you know, this is the West. We elect everybody. We elect the dog catcher, and we certainly elect judges. And I'm not here to ask you not to elect judges. That's fine. I ought to have to go out to the public at least every 6 years. I try to go out every couple of months and talk to some group. But I ought to have to go out and not only explain myself as a person, but explain what the courts do. It's always fun to do, because it's amazing how many people, otherwise solidly informed citizens about government, really are kind of surprised to find out what our responsibilities are and what the limitations on our authority are.
Any other questions? Representative Ackland.
Mr. Chair, I need to comment. Justice Gillette made the comment that the Supreme Court only gets noticed when they make a decision that makes people mad. Well, I believe that Justice Gillette has had many occasions to make people mad, because he's been a long-time girls' basketball official. And so people get to yell at him in that regard, at least. For the record.
Representing back the members of the committee, just to be completely complete about this. I'm a boys and girls high school basketball official. I've worked state tournaments. I've been at it for the same length of time I've been a judge. But for a significant period of time, I was also a baseball umpire. And Representative Backlund, in his former life, had an occasion to call into question my good judgment under those circumstances.
That is true.
Okay, very good. Other questions? Seeing none. Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
you. Chairman, thank you, and I thank the committee for your courtesies.
Okay. Are there any others here to testify on H.R. 42? Okay, we'll go ahead then and close the public hearing on H.R. 42. And, committee, I had thought we'd go back up on the agenda, Senate Bill 135, but I saw that House Bill 3093 has an individual here to testify from a distance. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and call Les Helgeson forward.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Les Helgeson. Representative Hobson's assistant, Debbie Boone, just stopped in, and I told her we were going to be last on the line, so she may want to stop in later if that's possible. I want to thank you for providing this hearing concerning House Bill 3093. Purpose here is really housekeeping of sorts to update the public records law to reflect changes, in fact, that many of us communicate by email these days. So I've lived on the Nestucca River over in Tillamook County for nearly 18 years now and regularly participate in local, state, and federal management processes. Lately, I've spent a lot of time here in Salem. Now, the impetus for this bill, my requesting this bill, comes from several incidents involving a state agency, a nonprofit organization, and a fishing guide who likes to frequent the Nestucca River, where I've lived for some time now. And I've attached some documents that document some of these problems. And I ended up submitting a request under the public records law to halt distribution by ODFW of my personally identifiable information. They granted that request. But it came to my attention that the law didn't provide for non-disclosure email address. So I tried to put an end to this. I wrote the perpetrator and asked that he cease his activities, and I ended up getting 3 virus attacks from this individual following my asking him to just, I don't want to deal with you now. So I ended up talking to state police, who then referred me to the FBI, because it turns out sending an email virus is not a state crime. And maybe we can address that next session. But at any rate, to make the long story short, it took a call to the FBI and a discussion with this individual, along with my attorney, to put an end to it. So really, these amendments that we're offering here are just to kind of update the existing public records law to prevent this sort of harassment by people who just don't believe we should exercise our rights here in the political process. We might disagree on some issues, but to start throwing around vulgarities and insults, it just, you've got to draw the line there. So I appreciate the opportunity to comment, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
I'm not sure I can follow this with these pages, your attachments.
Mm-hmm.
So you had written to someone, and then someone else got
Correct.
Explain a little bit better here.
It's, you know, some resource management issues, and I had written a letter to Luis Soliday, who was employed by the former governor, natural resources advisor, and expressed an issue regarding some budget matters. And apparently, he was the executive director of the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation, put in a records request for all correspondence I had with that agency, because I was essentially taking him on politically on some management issues pertaining to fish and fish management on the Mistaka River in my backyard, essentially. And consequently, he passed this information on to his fishing guide, who in turn contacted me and also made some posts on a fishing chat line, if you will, over there in Tillamook, and really started, I think, just trying to intimidate me to stop contacting the governor and Representative Hobson and others on this issue. And he continued to do that. And at the time, as I mentioned, we were in the middle of another war with Afghanistan at the time, and they start, you know, when you start getting referred to as a member of the Taliban and so forth, you get a little nervous, you know, about what this guy is going to do, given the language and the other attributes of his communication. I was, you know, justifiably concerned about my personal safety, and so my request was granted, but they couldn't cover the email aspect of it. It was simply, at the time, the original public records law was established, we didn't have email, generally speaking.
Okay, any questions? Other questions? Yes, Mr. Helgeson, do you, I think the one thing we saw was that it does add a new exemption on the, I guess, the Public Records Act, is that correct?
Yes. And I'd hope Debbie Boone from Representative Hobson's office would be here to explain that, but I think it does... Representative Hobson had that inserted, and I believe it's just to prevent, to broaden the scope so that, as I understand, I can call up or write or email, for example, a Fish and Wildlife Commission or something. But apparently if I testify at the commission, I can't make this request. I'm not the right person to answer that, unfortunately.
All right. Thank you, members. Any discussion while we're still in public hearing?
Mr. Chairman, the only thing that I... there's so much that's just public record, and I guess if you started exempting, that'd be very difficult. I believe what Mr. Helgeson has run into is what we often find where there are emotional issues and differences of opinion or concern. And that's not limited to fish hatcheries. That encumbers a whole group of issues. And I'm not sure of all of the alternatives that we have, but certainly harassment. There are a number of laws that can protect you. And I'm not sure about the email address. You can certainly change your email address. You may be able to help me here because I've not been involved in that particular thing. I wonder if harassment by email is something that has not been addressed or not looked at. But I don't think it's very easy to take one issue out of the public records or one area, but I have an open mind, so help me here.
Okay. Chair Doyle, Representative Berger. It's not really about the issue. It's about the unwanted contact. I believe the history of the public records law goes back to DMV. And I believe there's, it had to do with some divorces and unwanted contact. And that's really what the issue here. It's not limited to just an issue. Currently, I can request, on any issue that essentially you don't call me or visit my home or anything like this, or call me up. I mean, the law provides for this on virtually any issue. If you or somebody is presenting a tangible threat of sorts to me. All I'm asking with this bill is to expand that to include email contact by email as well. And it's independent of the issues. There's a level. We're not changing the threshold of the existing statute, if you will. So there are certain conditions under which this information can be withheld. And it would be helpful to withhold the email address as well, because it's very easy to, the idea of the existing statute is to prevent somebody, from doing ultimately physical harm to someone else. And it's very easy to track somebody through an email address. Probably easier to do that than with a phone contact. Okay. Am I answering your question?
A little bit. I'm just trying to get at the heart of it. Being a public official for a long time and certainly having issues, and certainly not everybody being happy with public officials, I sympathize with where you have a difference of opinion. And you have tried a police route. I mean, there are, various ways, restraining orders, so forth, to keep people away from you, to do right. you harm.
Correct.
My own experience as a mayor of a city is that email is a matter of public record. Email addresses are a matter of public record. And I'm not sure of how you would go in and say that certain things could be limited. Maybe that's where you can help me.
I see. Chair Doyle, Representative Berger. This doesn't prevent the disclosure of the actual email. It just prevents the disclosure of my address or my email address in this case. You can still disclose the email, and we're not trying to prohibit the actual
testimony. Okay. You also have certain public employees, though, in the bill. How would that work?
Unfortunately, Debbie Boone is
not
here.
And the public employees' retirement system records, see, those are paid by the taxpayer. So I don't, not all of them, that's right.
Yeah, Representative Berger and committee members, I've put a call in to legislative council to come in and kind of give us a bigger picture on this issue.
Thank
that
you.
Might give us a little bit of a hand and give a hand to Mr. Helgeson.
Thank you. Because that does go beyond what I had requested.
Right.
I simply asked for the email address non-disclosure.
Okay.
All right.
Any other questions for Mr. Helgeson before we move on to that? Okay. If you could stand by, and if there's other questions after this presentation, we might bring you forward again, but I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know Debbie will be back here soon, too.
Right. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Your judge has
Mr. Jamoff?
Years.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny.
Mr. Chair, members, Fred Jamoff, Office of the Council. How can I be of assistance?
Okay. With House Bill 3093, there's discussion about exempting electronic mail addresses from the public records law, and we started just asking Mr. Helgeson just some questions that got into more, I think, broader scope on exactly what, I guess we're just kind of looking maybe for a bigger picture on public records laws, the exemptions that basically, how does this one fit in to other exemptions? What kind of instances would we see this particular exemption being applied? And then I think a few of the members had specific questions as well. So we can, I guess, first get that overview.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, public records law expresses generally the legislature's determination that all records of the public's business are available
to the public for inspection. And then in a number of instances, this body has made the policy determination that certain records, sometimes in all instances, sometimes after a balancing test, looking at the need for a person's privacy and the public's need to know, may or may not be required to be produced to someone who requests. The general rule is that a public record is subject to inspection by the public, but there are dozens of exceptions, often which you put into the code to protect an individual's privacy. The principal statute that would be amended in House Bill 3093 already allows for a person who is either in the employer or volunteer of the public body to ask the public body to not disclose that person's telephone number or address, I presume, given the prevalence of electronic mail as a means of communication these days. The request for the measure is to protect that common means of communication with those folks as well.
Specific questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess on what basis now can a person do that? They couldn't do that for me. I mean, I'm elected. I'm a public official. So this would not include public officials, because even for your safety.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I do believe that if you, generally speaking, the exemption from disclosing your personal address, phone number, that sort of thing, does not apply to you because you're a public official. Right. My understanding is, however, that if you can show that you are somehow in danger, that ORS 192.445 provides a separate basis for you to say, notwithstanding the fact that normally I can't withhold this information, I'd like to have it withheld in this case because there's someone who may hurt me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then other questions? Representative Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if there's a difference between, evidently in statute, we can exempt telephone number. And how is electronic mail address different from telephone number? I mean, to me, there doesn't seem to be a problem to exempt electronic mail address. Or is that, are we not able to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, looking at the issue from, for example, my role as a state agency director, it wouldn't be fundamentally different for us to withhold an electronic mail address just the way we would withhold a telephone number or an address.
Okay. And, Paul, and is there, are you, can you do that? I mean, I guess we'd have to talk to an IS person. I mean, are there, I've heard that it's very easy to get email addresses.
And, well, Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, this would be your personal electronic mail address, not your work address. And the way the public records law works, a person would ask the public body for example, your personal electronic mail address. And if adopted, House Bill 3093 would give the public body the authority to say, thank you, we don't choose to give you that. So there really shouldn't be any technical fixes needed to implement the law.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chamoff, then looking at sections 2 and 3 of the bill, where then it goes on to actually exempt from disclosure the the public records, and it's the very last line of those sections. For instance, on page 5, line 43-44, where it's now, I guess there's, it's an expansion, it seems, of those exemptions for address, telephone number, and email address. Can you comment on, I guess, why section 1 alone wouldn't, I guess, just cover the concern that if a person just wanted to request that it not be disclosed, that would be enough? I mean, why do we have to make it a specific exemption?
Mr. Chair, members, the difference between sections 2 and 3 of the bill and section 1 is this. Under what I would call the general public records law exceptions, if a person comes and says, I'd like to know the address, telephone number, electronic mail address, if you choose to add it, of a public employee or volunteer, then the public body does sort of a balancing test, trying to decide, well, how important is it for us to turn over this information to the person asking versus how important is it to my employee not to have that information turned over? There currently is, in this general statute, an exemption for personal addresses and phone numbers. The bill would add electronic mail addresses to that. The parts of the bill that you highlighted on page 5, lines 43 and 44, and on page 9, lines 34 and 35, would expand the exemptions to witnesses at public meetings, and exempting their names, their addresses, phone numbers, and electronic mail would be at least new in concept to the Public Records Act. Section 1 of the bill provides a way for a person to essentially get out of the balancing test. If a person can establish to the satisfaction of the public body that there is some risk to that person as a result of the disclosure of personal information, such as where that person can be found, then the public body doesn't have to go through the weighing test. The public body will and indeed must withhold that information. So Section 1 deals with the situation when a person is in danger. The other sections have to do more with a person's privacy generally, but not necessarily when the person is in danger.
And to follow up, one of the, examples that was presented to me earlier was when a public official, for instance, receives email addresses, maybe by being copied on an email or having an email sent to them, and they have huge list of people that maybe were copied with that email. What would happen with those particular email addresses? Would that be considered a public record? That, for instance, if you got a whole block of email addresses on the document, does that have to be disclosed?
Mr. Chair, most likely yes. If it were an electronic mail message directed to a member of the Legislative Assembly, likely not, but members of the Legislative Assembly have a somewhat broader exception than other public officials do. But normally I would think, yes, that would be a document that a person would be required to disclose.
Okay. Other questions?
I am trying to...
Representative Richter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get my arms around this issue. One of the things in the bill is about witnesses or people testifying at a public meeting, which, of course, is free speech. If you sign up to speak and are required to put down an address or a phone number, is that a public record, or is that a record only for the person who is in charge of the meeting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that's a public record, which is why the exceptions or the exemptions for that are proposed in this bill.
In the bill. But,
Sure, Representative Moss Anderson.
To make sure I'm understanding what the representative from Coos Bay is saying, I thought we only need to deal with content. When we get down to address, phone number, that is not public record. And therefore, adding electronic email is not public record. Isn't it different? I mean, I guess I don't know the definition of public record. Public record, I wouldn't think. Yes, you have to have your name, but not necessarily your phone number, your address, your electronic record. I mean, I don't know if that's what you're at, but that's where I'm... What I'm wanting to know is what public record really is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moniz Anderson, whether or not government requires you to provide certain information before you testify, if you do, you put down your name, your address, your telephone number, your electronic mail address, and you provide that to the government as part of the information that you are conveying as part of your testimony in some sort of a hearing, that document is a public record.
Representative Close.
I just make an additional comment. I have testified at city council hearings where the address was required on the sign-in sheet. And because of that, I received 100 magazine subscriptions. And though it was very annoying canceling all those, I did not report that to the police. I figured, you know, there is a cost when you speak out, and that is, you know, it does happen to all of us. I want you to know.
Okay. Yes, Representative Hacklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, this bill, as I consider it, does not establish some new precedent. It simply expands on what has been done previously. Would you concur with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, I think the answer to that question is a matter of degree. Certainly adding electronic mail addresses to the list of information that a public body need not disclose about employees and volunteers is not a significant policy choice, at least in my view. Whether to allow a public body to withhold information about witnesses at hearings or at public meetings, while it's the same kind of information that a public body has had the authority to withhold if that was information about its own employees or about its volunteers, I think a person could argue is at least enough of a different policy decision to be considered significant.
I guess maybe the only other thing I was thinking about too is potential liability for those who do disclose addresses or email addresses after this is passed. What happens in that case?
Mr. Chair, the public records law doesn't deal with what happens if a public body discloses information that it's required to keep confidential. The public records law starts with the general proposition that the public is entitled to all public documents and then gives the public body the discretion to withhold documents in certain circumstances. But just because there is an opportunity for a public body to withhold a document, let's say, for example, you adopt this law and a person comes to me saying, I would like the electronic mail addresses of my employees, and I've not received any kind of a request to withhold that because anyone's in danger. It's just the general balancing. I can't incur any liability because I have the opportunity not to disclose it if I so choose, but unless I take advantage of that opportunity, I'm required to disclose the information. This gives a public body an additional tool, but it certainly doesn't require keeping things confidential, except in the circumstance where a person comes and provides satisfactory evidence that they're in danger.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help. Debbie Boone, do you have any comments? Okay. Wasn't sure. Thank you. Well, committee, we're going to go ahead and hold off on this, and I think, Mr. Helgeson, I'd suggest you, if you have interest in getting this passed, you need to discuss this a little further among the committee members. You've already seen, obviously seen some issues that some folks have, but and see if we can proceed from that point. Okay. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and now open up public hearing on Senate Bill 135. And Tom Rush.
Thank you, Chairman Doyle, members of the committee. I am Tom Roush, representing the Secretary of State. It's my pleasure to testify before you today on Senate Bill 135A, and you are getting my written testimony, so I'll keep my remarks brief. This is a simple bill. It really is. The all it does is direct the Secretary of State to adopt rules, administrative rules, for the electronic equivalent of the notary public seal. The notary public right now, any kind of notarization has to be done, finished off with a rubber stamp. You've probably seen that. We don't use embossers anymore, although you may. When the legislature chose to allow electronic notarizations, this was overlooked. If the way the law stands right now, you would still require a rubber stamp on an electronic document, making a mixture of media a little difficult, to say the least. So all we're asking is to give the authority to rectify that oversight and create an administrative rule that would create the electronic equivalent, functional equivalent of the rubber stamp seal that is required on notarizations now. This has no, this changes nothing as far as the security of electronic documents. It doesn't change the law regarding electronic notarization. All it does is allow for electronic seal in place of the rubber stamp. And with that, I urge you to pass this bill and I'm open to questions.
Right. Any questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us what your plan is, how you're going to do this? And I know several other states have this. Can you tell us how other states do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I actually don't have a plan ready for you today. That would be in the administrative rules process. There are, as you say, there are several states that have are looking at this. Arizona is one, and there's been Minnesota has had rules and then are rescinding them. And they vary all the way from just a graphic overlay on top of the electronic document to say, you know, the notary public did see this, to a very involved process called digital signatures. I don't know if you're familiar with that technology, but it's quite extensive, secure technology that has had mixed reviews in the marketplace. We're certainly looking at that option, and there are some vendors that have come and gone using that technology, and one of the reasons why we've been shy about that technology is that the marketplace is very volatile in that way. But the point is that the administrative rules process would put this before the public and say, this is what we're thinking. Is this secure enough? Is this convenient enough? Is this economical enough for you to use? And based on those comments and the testimony we get, then we'll make the decision as the administrative rules process always works.
Mr. Chair, because this is a guarantee that this is an authentic signature, I think it's really important that this is done right, and I would like to have on the record some kind of indication of what the plan is, that how they would do this through rules, what their path would be before I would feel comfortable giving them the authority and not having it be something that we put in statute ourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. In order to have something notarized now, I have to go to someone that has the rubber stamp. So when you do it electronically, would there still be certain individuals that would be notary publics, or would that mean, okay, so there would be only certain ways that people would be able to electronically send you something that had been notarized?
Yes. Chairman Doyle, Representative Berger, this is a problem we had in the on the Senate side, too. It's very difficult to understand the difference between the electronic notarization part and the electronic and the seal. The seal is just it's something you affix to the document as a notary. The notary public, in both the electronic notarization and the physical notarization, their requirements are the same. You still have to go to an official notary public commissioned by the Secretary of State of Oregon. They still have to go through the process of identifying you and making sure that you are the person who was actually signing the document. There has to be personal appearance, etc. Because electronic notarization is a difficult thing, because it's a new medium, and quite frankly, there is no uniform way of looking at how electronic notarization should best be done. And yet, the federal government, through the Electronic Signatures and Global National Commerce Act in the year 2000, and this body in the year 2001, have said electronic notarization should be enabled. We have to allow for that. And we frankly have not said, for the state of Oregon, this is how you will do electronic notarizations, because it's been a moving target, we'll be honest with you. And the appropriate technology, has not been really clear. So we've been very careful. We've been taking our time to adopt this, and I really do not have a plan to present to you this is how it will work. I can tell you how some states have envisioned it and how some vendors have pitched it to us, and this is how it goes. You would have, if you did the most secure way, you would have come to a notary public and say, for example, a mortgage company, say, I'd like to get this document done, and say, okay, we're going to notarize it. And you're up on the computer screen, and there's a signature component of that application, the software application, and you may be issued, or you may already have, something called a digital certificate, which states that you are who you say you are, and there's a trusted third party, it's a vendor someplace that gave you this certificate. You stick that, there's a token that you would stick in the computer, it reads it, says, yeah, you are, and it makes an encrypted message about that. The notary, seeing you've done that, then does the same kind of thing for themselves. As an encrypted, they encrypt their message and it says, I am who I say I am. And the whole document becomes unalterable electronically. And then it gets shot off to whoever it's supposed to go to. That receiver of that document can then can verify those two certificates by going back to the trusted third party who issued that little smart token. And it can say, yes, those people really are the people who they say they are. The notary seal part of it is not necessarily that encryption part. It may be. But often what the vendors are showing us now is it's really just a graphic image of the same thing you have with a rubber stamp. The notarization part of it is still the same type of procedures. The technology varies depending upon the state and the way people have decided to implement it. Some documents are high-risk documents are going to need the most secure methods and may use the method I just outlined to you. Some documents may not be as secure, may not need as an involved process as I just outlined. We don't have rules in place yet. We have been given the chance, the direction by the legislature, create rules for electronic notarization, but even with those rules in place, they do nothing without saying we don't have to put a rubber stamp on it. And that's what this bill does. It says you don't have to put a rubber stamp on an electronic document. You can have the electronic equivalent of the rubber stamp, but I don't have to actually take an India ink stamp and put it on the computer screen.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
having been a notary and having just a little familiarity with digital signatures and the development of that, and also with authentication of privacy and so on. And this really scares me that I'm just kind of getting what you're talking about. I tend to support the concept, but I'm anxious also. I'm anxious to see how it's going to evolve or be developed. So I guess you can't go forward. Do I understand you can't go forward without our approval to do so?
Chairman Doyle, Representative Forrest, that's right.
Okay. Other questions? And Tom, when you're saying you can't go forward, I'm assuming that means you cannot actually adopt a means to do electronic notarizations, but you could still pursue getting some kind of plan put together on what Oregon would be doing if you had this authorization.
Chairman Doyle, yes, that's true. We could do something. If we had that authorization, we could put a plan together. We'd hope to go through a rather extensive public hearing process on that, and you guys will probably be gone by the time that would take place. But I could put some proposals together, but those would be just our concepts of how that might work. If you'd like to do that, I'd certainly be happy to provide that.
Well, we're getting a little bit of concern, I guess, obviously, so
sure.
Maybe if you can talk to the couple of committee members that have that concern, and we'll see if we can bring it back.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's then close the public hearing on Sentinel 135, and we can, Tom, don't worry, open up public hearing on House Bill 3351. And members, this actually, I think, was presented or proposed by the Sheriff's Association, and the representative of the Sheriff's Association is actually caught up in a Senate committee hearing that, he was just had the conflict on this, so wanted to let Tom Roche give his discussion about it, and then we'll see if there are questions about this bill, whether we need to hold this one over as well or whether we can move it out. So, Tom, go ahead.
Well, thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Tom Rush with the Secretary of State's office, and in one of my hats in the Secretary of State, as you probably have gathered, is I'm the supervisor of the Notary Public Section, and I've become very aware of the problem this bill seeks to address. There are certain very stringent standards, not as stringent as some states, but more stringent than most states, for identification that notaries are allowed to use in order to identify people who sign before them. Unfortunately, and I really don't want to go into this because I'm sure the Sheriff's Association could do a better job of it than I could, there are some difficulties with that. Inmates generally don't have on them their ID cards, and that's been a problem. And so we've worked with Department of Corrections and some other folks on this, and I know the Sheriff's Association had talked to us before that told us this was a problem, but they never told us what they were going to do about it. And so I come to you not having talked with them, and I apologize, but I haven't been able to get a hold of them. There was just a few concerns. We're neutral on this bill, but a few concerns with the language that we thought we would make the committee aware of. And the first suggestion is that the language may be a little broad in where it says, and I'm sorry, I don't have the bill in front of me, but it says that the bill is positively identified, a concern on the second page, page 2, line 5, it starts, the person is confined in a correctional facility, and here's the broad language, has been positively identified by the facility through fingerprints or other methods. And it appears questionable to us that every method the correctional facility may take to identify people is equally acceptable. We have every respect for the correctional facilities. We know they want to make sure they get the right people in the facility. but from our standpoint, in terms of regulating notaries and letting them know what to expect and how to notarize properly in this circumstance, it seems like some standard that we can point to and say this is what you're going to be held to would be very positive for us, and that's it's one of our roles is to try to get, help notaries have some certainty in this process, and one of our roles is to try to help guide them, and we really wouldn't be guided as to what method they're supposed to be relying on. And that brings up the second point, which
well,
is simply...
Well, Tom, let me interrupt yes. before you move on. It would seem to me, though, that just by rule, you would be setting up a separate procedure on how notaries public would be going in and you know, signing off on documents that are in the corrections element or those institutions. I mean, what wouldn't there be ways, I guess, by rule that you'd be working with the corrections officials and the Sheriff's Association to find out what those methods are and how to assure the notaries public that they are definitely, I guess, identifying the right individual? No, Chairman, you don't need it in statute.
Well, Chairman Doyle, we haven't really ever done rules on identification so much because it's been a very important part of the statute that is statutorily based. We could work on rules. My understanding has been that the means of positive identification varies quite a bit depending upon the type of facility. And I don't know all the ramifications in the various types of facilities that would be under this rule. It just struck us as when it says they're positively identified by fingerprints or other methods, that other methods could include somebody saying, "You, I know you are who you say you are," and that's enough. That's not necessarily bad. I'm not saying that this is a bad bill or anything. I'm just saying that it's difficult for us to know how to tell a notary what to rely on and what the standard of reliance is. The other thing relates to it, and that is, it doesn't say how a notary is supposed to access this positive identification, how they're supposed to verify. If you look at the other types of satisfactory evidence, that's the statutory language. It's an ID card generally. It's something that you grasp. The notary is supposed to look at this ID. In fact, we had to change a law to allow bank signature cards to be ID used as satisfactory evidence because it was clear to us and to the Bankers Association that it wasn't ID issued to somebody, so they wouldn't have it on them to give to the notary. And so we had to make it really clear that the notary should be somebody who has access to the bank signature card in order for them to use that, to rely on that. In the same way, the notary should be able to have access to this positive identification by the correctional facility. It doesn't say how the notary is supposed to have access to that. And you're right, Chairman Doyle, it's possible that we could do administrative rule. I'm not sure if our authority extends that far, but if it does, and if it's the will of the committee, we'd be happy to work with that. My understanding is that changes from facility to facility from time to time, but we're certainly happy to work. But we just wanted to, for the record, let the committee know that this language is broader and lacks that access component that other similar language has been that addressed this problem.
Okay. Questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we might not just go through some example here. I'm serving in a correctional institution. I have papers that need to be notarized. Would there be a notary within that staff, someone that acts as a notary within the staff at a correctional facility?
Chairman Doyle, Representative Berger, yes. Generally, there are, and it depends on the facility what type of ID is available to that notary and what how they serve in that facility. Some notaries will have access to the records of inmates through their other job, you know, and they can go to the inmates and say, okay, inmate number 1357, you are, upon our records, John Doe. You may claim to be Jason Doe, and that happens,
sure.
But we know that you're John Doe, and if you give me paperwork as John Doe, I'm going to rely on that. Our records as well. And I think that's what this bill is trying to get to.
Okay.
To allow the notary to use those records. I don't know that they always have that. I understand the Department of Corrections has, the State Department of Corrections has has ID, I think it's a bracelet actually, that is issued to inmates, that has been changed to conform to the requirements of our of the statute now, that include a signature, for example, and a picture and a physical description.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Notaries public are required to keep a record book now. They have for the past number of years. And if going across the ledger, it's a date of the document, type of document, the person who is being notarized, whose signature is being authenticated, their address, and then there is certain type of identification that's required unless the signer is known to the notary public, in which case you can indicate personal knowledge.
Now, you still be a notary. You're doing great.
I took the open book test.
Good for you.
Numbers of times. Then there is certain documentation that is otherwise required if the person is not known to the notary public. Is part of that documentation not some piece of photo ID?
Chair Doyle, Representative Flores, it can be. Two basic ways of having satisfactory evidence. One is a picture ID, piece of identification issued by a government that has photo, physical attributes, and a signature. Or you can rely on two or more pieces of identification issued by government, business, institution, etc., that merely have a signature. And all these ID must be valid. And you are absolutely correct that identification, the information about that identification, whether it's driver's license number, expiration date, that kind of stuff, needs to be in the journal. And that's the law on that is in this section one. That's we're talking about that law.
Okay.
Sure.
And so, from your knowledge then of this bill, are we trying to put in the piece that perhaps inmate identification number would be an acceptable piece of identification?
Well, Chairman Doyle, Representative Flores, that's the question. I'm not sure what I would instruct the notaries to put down. If I would say inmate identification number, or if I would say your database reference number, or how you're identified. I really don't know, and that's what I'm talking about when I say it's a little open, and we don't know what the standard process will be, so we won't know what to tell the notaries to put in their journal or to look for.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And like I said, members, we didn't have the proponent here. And I think what I will do, though, is still go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3351 and open a work session on House Bill 3351. Discussion?
Well, I guess I would just like to ask Representative Flores give her opinion on the bill, since you are a professional.
Well, actually, my notary expired, so. I think that if what they're trying to do is add another component of acceptable identification, I don't have a problem with it. So, thank you.
Okay. Other discussion? All right. Let's call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess we need a motion. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the Rules and Public Affairs Committee approve.
Move
that we approve. Or we move this up. What do I say?
House Bill 3351 to the floor.
That we move House Bill 3351 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3351 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Seeing none, we can now call the roll.
Aye.
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 And House Bill 3351 does pass. Representative Flores, want to carry it?
Sure.
All right, be carried by Representative Flores. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3351. And I think that didn't leave any open, any recesses or hearings. Okay, great. And thank you, members. Appreciate your patience today. And we are adjourned.